When I was a teenager, my brother and sister and I went to see the movie The Exorcist. Truth be told, we were probably too young for it, especially my little brother. You remember that scene where the camera would pan up a stairway heading toward the bedroom where the little girl was possessed by the devil? About the third time that happened, the audience was silent, and my brother couldn't stand it anymore, and he just blurted out, "Oh no, not again!" And of course cracked everybody up, a little bit of unintentional comic relief. Well, that movie and other depictions of satanic rituals in the media apparently have had a fairly profound effect on our society and ultimately on our interpretation of the religion clauses of the Constitution, at least according to our next guest. His name is Lucian Greaves, and he's from a place called the Satanic Temple. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about Satan.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
You've probably noticed that every few years there's some dispute over some religious group or some politician who wants to put a Ten Commandments monument up at some public building. The ACLU or Americans United for Separation of Church and State, or maybe just an individual plaintiff will then file a lawsuit and the case will go to court and the result will be... Those results aren't always consistent, are they? This is a really messed up area of First Amendment law. It's called the Establishment Clause, this particular area of jurisprudence, and the United States Supreme Court really has not made up its mind what the standards are for governmental display of religion, of religious artifacts, of religious monuments of this sort. Our next guest, or our guest today, our primary guest today, is a fellow by the name of Lucian Greaves, and he's from a group called, now wait for it, the Satanic Temple. How did he come to my attention? Well, it seems that one of these Ten Commandments cases come our way out of Oklahoma. Apparently, the state legislator there has donated a Ten Commandments monument to the state capitol, and it's been put up, and the ACLU has sued. And in the meantime, these fellows, these Satan worshipers who have their own satanic religion, said, we don't necessarily think that the Ten Commandments should be up, but if it is up, then we want to put up our monument too. And our monument, says Lucian Greaves, is a monument to Lucifer. You can imagine the sort of reaction that that has engendered in Oklahoma, and you can also see the constitutional issue. If the Establishment Clause of the Constitution requires some sort of neutrality with regard to religion, well, then it's going to be kind of hard for those Oklahoma guys to say yes to the Ten Commandments, but no to Satan. But to discuss this in more detail is my go-to guy on the First Amendment, my colleague and friend from the Appalachian School of Law. His name is Doug McKechnie, and you've heard from him before, and you're going to enjoy hearing from him again.
Thank you again for inviting me, Stuart. I really appreciate
Absolutely.
The opportunity to talk with you.
Every time I feel the need to learn a new dirty word, first thing I think of is Doug McKechnie. So you're going to teach me some new dirty words today?
You know, today, there's always a possibility that a dirty word is going to come up when I'm here to talk with you, Stuart. But today I think we'll be able to avoid any words that my mom wouldn't be happy to hear.
That is really disappointing. And I'm sure that everybody agrees with me that's disappointing. But we do have a subject that people might still find objectionable.
Yes, and what is
that subject?
So today we're going to talk about what the law is with regard to when the government wants to display religious iconography or religious symbols. How does the Supreme Court determine whether or not that's a violation of the First Amendment?
And we're specifically going to talk about that in the context of...
Of Satan.
Satan.
I think it seems like we need some reverberations or some echo.
Satan.
Yes.
We will talk about, okay, that's what a lot of people might find objectionable, or arguably something that younger children might not want to be exposed to, because it's a frightening concept, and many people are very, very concerned about it. So, okay, that's your warning. Now, what is this? What's the story here? Or what's the general landscape when some group or when a government wants to put a religious monument, whether it's satanic or whether it's more traditional, on public property?
Well, I wish the answer, and I think that a lot of lawyers and judges wish that the answer was easy. But the reality is it's not. The Supreme Court for the past 10, 20 years has really struggled to articulate a constitutional analysis for religious displays in public spaces. And really, I think if we try to boil down, the cases have kind of bounced back and forth, and there was even a time when two cases came out at the same time, and they seemed to kind of conflict with each other. The Supreme Court decided two cases, and they conflicted, and it was a little bit of an odd situation. But really, I think when we try to boil down the law and try to understand how it's applied, the Supreme Court and federal courts are going to examine whether or not the government's use of an object with religious meaning is how it's viewed by the kind of passerby, how the person who's walking by the display would look at the display and what he or she might think about the display, and whether the display is meant for religious purpose or a secular purpose. And that really is going to turn on the context of the display.
Okay. And the relevant constitutional provision here is the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, right?
That's correct.
Because if a government displays a religious symbol, there is at least a danger that a passerby would perceive it as an endorsement of a particular religion, or maybe an endorsement of religion generally over non-religion, and that would tend toward the establishment of official state church, and that's what the First Amendment prohibits.
Right. The idea behind the Establishment Clause really is, probably at its most fundamental core, is that government should be neutral with regard to religion. That means it should neither endorse religion nor disfavor religion.
Okay. And so that's what's at stake here. And you say the cases have kind of gone all over the place, but the essential concept that's emerged from them is that there's context.
There is context. We want to, the Supreme Court has charged the lower courts and the lawyers and the litigants to really take a look at almost a picture, literally take a picture of the display, the religious display that the government is putting forth, maybe on a park or in a park or on a county courthouse. Take a picture of it and say, okay, what do we have in this picture? Do we have just one single religious, religiously connected display, some kind of iconography, maybe a cross or perhaps the Ten Commandments or some other kind of symbol of a religion? Is it standing alone? Is it standing with other symbols, whether religious or otherwise? And then what is the message, what appears to be the message that the government's trying to send with that either singular display or multiple displays in one location?
Right. Multiple displays would indicate perhaps that the government's not playing favorites. Multiple displays that include secular items might indicate that it really wasn't intended for a religious purpose, maybe perhaps more of a historical purpose. And even timing is important. I mean, an old display that's been around 70 years that only recently has become an issue, that might be considered acceptable, whereas something that is specifically put there right now in 2014 could be considered to be making more of a religious statement, especially in the context of the legislative history leading up to it.
That's right. In fact, one of the Supreme Court cases that I was referring to earlier, one of these cases that kind of came out and it was a little bit confusing for people who litigate in this area, was a case in which the government put forth a religious display and they got some complaints and they got a lawsuit and they said, well, let's put some other things with that religious display. Maybe let's put some historical documents. Let's put some other maybe slightly religious documents or slightly religious iconography. That didn't really work. And so they actually came up with a new idea. There was a third version of this religious display. And so the idea that the government was, what I think trying to accomplish was, and the Supreme Court kind of called them out for this, look, the original display was religious, and then you were just trying to cover your rear end with adding some...
Dress it up.
Yeah, just trying to add in some historical context to make it kind of pass muster, pass this kind of constitutional question, and trying to almost secularize what was originally a religious display.
Right. In contrast, there are lots and lots of older icons. In fact, I believe including a display of Moses bearing the Ten Commandments in the main argument chamber at the Supreme Court. That would not necessarily be considered unconstitutional because they were done a long time ago. It's part of history. It's part of tradition. They've been up there a long time. There's no suggestion that they were done in order to favor one particular religion. Therefore, those are probably okay. So this leaves us with a pretty vague area of law, doesn't it? A very fact-specific case-by-case analysis.
It is. It's going to really turn on history. It's going to turn on context. And really, it also depends on, like a lot of the Supreme Court cases that we will talk about, it also depends on which judges are in the majority and which judges are writing the dissent. And so if you have a judge like Scalia, Justice Scalia says, look, it's okay to have religious displays. And they don't even necessarily need to be secular. We can have displays that are celebrating things like the Ten Commandments as long as it's not proselytizing. We can celebrate them because they are religious or spiritual, and that's okay. It need not necessarily be secular.
He's called an accommodationist. He's willing to accommodate religious ideas, but there are other Supreme Court justices who feel the other way.
That's right.
And they're more Jeffersonian in their perspective, which is any government display of religion is going to be suspect for violating that wall of separation, as Jefferson said. Okay, well, you're aware of this case that we're going to be talking about today, this Satanic Temple case. So what's going on here?
Well, it seems as though what Oklahoma has done has set up a situation that they could accept a private donation to be placed on public land in a pretty prominent area. I mean, typically when the Supreme Court or any court is examining a religious display, they're going to look and see, you know, what else is around and where is the display. And so in situations where we have religious displays in a courthouse or right outside of a courthouse, maybe even as opposed to kind of somewhere no one ever goes in a public park. I mean, that doesn't come up very often, but I'm just trying to give something to distinguish this from.
If it's right in your face.
If it's right in your face.
A public building, when you're going in to go to court, when you're going in to do government business.
Yeah, I got
to
get my driver's license.
And there it is.
There it is.
There it is.
And if it's the only thing there, right? If there's no, and we kind of get back to this concept of context, if there's nothing else around that would demonstrate to the passerby that this is just a celebration of history and culture as opposed to some kind of proselytizing or, you know, ye who enter this door must know that this is the foundation for our government, the Ten Commandments or whatever other display is there, then the court is going to turn, the answer or the analysis is going to turn, you know, on that place that the thing is displayed, the physical location of where it's displayed, and then what else is around it. And so it seems like here we've got a situation where this is right in front of, I think, the county courthouse or the state capitol.
Okay, so
significant area.
Oklahoma has actually more or less invited private donors to donate monuments, and the very first one was a monument to the Ten Commandments. And there it sits, and prominently all by itself. It's been challenged by the ACLU when they're going to litigate it on the basis of the sort of laws we've just discussed. But in the meantime, as that case is pending, this fellow Lucian Greaves of the Satanic Temple, and we'll be talking to him today too, has said, okay, great, I'm going to take your invitation at face value, and here's my donation of my religious monument, and it is a monument to Satan. How do you react to this?
Well, I think that this is one of those situations where the government, in its desire to perhaps accomplish a goal, which may have been to get the Ten Commandments in front of the Capitol building, may have opened itself up to either go whole hog into it and accept anything that anyone wants to donate that could be a celebration of history or law or religion, a secular celebration of these things that we all share. It's either going to go that route, or it's going to resist that kind of all can come in and all can and put forth their displays. Or it's going to say, no, we're just going to stick with this one display. But if it does that, then it may set itself up for an allegation that it really is endorsing one particular religion or really favoring one religion or one group of religious tenets over another.
Well, Doug, thank you for setting that up for us today. And now I think I want to go talk to Lucian Greaves and see exactly what's going on with these devil worshipers.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my friend and colleague, or I've just finished speaking with my friend and colleague, Doug McKechnie of the Appalachian School of Law, who's my go-to guy on the First Amendment. And he's just been explaining, or trying to explain, this very difficult area of First Amendment law, a particular area we call Establishment Clause law, and more specifically, the part of the Establishment Clause jurisprudence that governs the public or governmental display of religious iconography or religious monuments, that sort of thing. After the break, we will actually speak to another fellow about this very issue in a very specific context. He's called Lucian Greaves, and he runs a place called the Satanic Temple. Stick around. I'm serious. You really don't want these guys mad at you.
Once again, it's time for, oh my gosh, Doug Smith is wearing what look like his green jammies. He must be
the Riddler.
The Riddler. Thanks so much. I am so much looking forward to another good riddle. Do we have a contestant on the line, though?
Yeah, yes, you do.
Well, who's our contestant?
My name's Nick, and I'm from Kingsport, Tennessee.
From Kingsport, Tennessee. Are there ports in Tennessee?
No, it's actually named after the guy that founded Kingsport. It was actually called Kingsport, but that just kind of, over time, it just kind of ran together to name the town.
I had no idea. Well, now we know where the name Kingsport came from. I've kind of wondered about that. It's in northeast Tennessee, right?
Yes.
Well, tremendous. Okay, well, we've got Nick from Kingsport on the line, and you've got a tough riddle for him, don't you?
I do. How are you, Nick?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Okay, so here it comes. So I'm going to read the riddle. I'm going to give you a couple of choices, okay?
All right,
here it goes. I wanted liberty, but I would have taken death. I had a keen sense of smell, especially for rats. And that kept me out of Philadelphia. Who am I?
That's a good riddle. What are the answers?
Could you say it again?
He needs to hear it again, sure.
Okay. I wanted liberty, mm-hmm. but I would have taken death. I had a keen sense of smell, especially for rats, and that kept me out of Philadelphia. Who am I? Is it George Mason? Patrick Henry? John Huntsman? Or James Madison?
Sounds like Patrick Henry to me.
It sounds like Patrick Henry to you out of all four of those. Why were you zeroing in immediately on Patrick Henry?
Well, I grew up in Virginia, and trust me, they beat you in Virginia history. They gave me liberty to give me death speech.
So you basically, Nick, are a ringer. You told us you were from Kingsport, Tennessee, but you grew up in Virginia. And so they taught you in school all about the liberty and death speech, and Doug is just smiling, and I think that means...
Yeah, he's right. It is. It is, in fact, Patrick Henry. Okay. What he may not know is it's Patrick Henry, the ne'er-do-well.
The ne'er-do-well.
Yeah, you may not know this, Nick. Patrick Henry, not such a talented guy. I mean, he was very, very smart, but... He didn't do a whole lot. He wasn't a hard worker. Everybody knew he was smart, but he kind of didn't do a whole lot with those smarts early on. He got set up in his own company, which he bankrupted. And at one point, Hanover County, Virginia, where he was living, kind of people around the community thought he should just leave because he wasn't contributing at all. And in the end,
when he was in the House of Burgess,
decided just to become a lawyer.
When he was in the House of Burgess, which is like the General Assembly now in Virginia, he issued his seven points. I don't remember exactly what they were called, but it was basically saying, one point was anybody that disagreed with him was a traitor and to the patriotic cause and crap like that. It was kind of weird.
So he did he said the weird stuff in the House of Burgesses too.
Yeah, he was actually just a crazy fanatic that people just kind of idolized over history.
Between you and Doug, you were just tearing Patrick Henry to pieces. He was, well, I don't know of anyone who'd say he was a fanatic, Nick. Isn't that a little bit of an overstatement?
Not overstatement.
Really. Not in my opinion.
You and Doug are just beating up on Patrick Henry. Well, I have to put in a plug for some recent episodes we did. I actually went out to Patrick Henry's his home down in Red Hill, Virginia, and got a very different version of Patrick Henry that was much more admiring. But like most historical figures, he's going to get people on both sides of it. But the most important thing, Nick, is that you got the question right, and so you're going to get a Weekly Constitutional T-shirt. And so what you need to do is send your T-shirt size to our scheduler at ywc@montpelier.org, and she will be very, very happy to send you a T-shirt and a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Awesome.
Well, thanks very much for playing, Nick.
No problem. Thank you.
All right.
You know, Stuart, Patrick Henry is actually an interesting character in the American history.
Mm-hmm.
And we shouldn't say that it just ended with him becoming a lawyer. He, in fact, was a governor of Virginia.
He was.
He was invited to be the first Secretary of State of the United States by George Washington, but refused to do it.
Another flaky action.
You know, and he really wasn't very supportive of the Constitutional Convention. He thought too much was done in secret, and it didn't really protect or states' rights. As, mm-hmm. as a future governor, you might imagine that he would take that tack.
In fact, I think Patrick Henry was probably one of the primary reasons they didn't send the Constitution to state legislatures for ratification, because they knew people like him would gut it.
Very, very critical. Very critical. And quite eloquent.
Oh, yes.
Which made his critical thinking, which he was a very, very smart fellow, his critical thinking that much more dangerous to the early republic. Because the man could move a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
He really, really could.
I think this is, now we finally understand where Doug is coming from, because of course we love James Madison on this program, and James Madison and Patrick Henry were just enemies.
Enemies.
Enemies, absolute enemies. And in fact, that reminds me of another thing. I just had a really wonderful debate between the interpreters at Colonial Williamsburg who play James Madison and Patrick Henry. And they actually had a debate over the ratification right there in the studio with me. You got to catch that episode, Doug. I think you really like it.
I'm going to love that. Hey, another thing, Stuart. One last thing before we leave. Hanover County, the home of Patrick Henry. Guess who was born there?
Who was born there?
Dolly Madison.
Oh,
we'll
that's
pick that up in a future episode.
Indeed we will. Well, thanks, Doug. We appreciate your time as always.
As you know, it's the Constitution. I read it for the article, Stuart.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and before the break, my colleague and friend Doug McKechnie of the Appalachian School of Law was talking about a really interesting case out of Oklahoma. It seems that the Oklahoma legislature has authorized donations of monuments to the state, and one of their own legislators has done that. He's out of the goodness of his heart. He's donated a Ten Commandments monument, which is being displayed on the grounds of the State House in Oklahoma. And also out of the goodness of his heart, a fellow by the name of Lucian Greaves, who's from a place called the Satanic Temple, has donated his own statue, or is preparing a statue for donation. And this one is a statue of, well, Satan. And we're going to talk to Lucian Greaves here in just a minute, because this really and truly highlights in a very stark way just exactly what the First Amendment, specifically the Establishment Clause, mean.
Well, I am Lucian Greaves, and I'm the spokesperson for the Satanic Temple.
The Satanic Temple. Now, that requires a little bit of explanation.
Absolutely. We're a religious-based organization. It's actively involved in politics or political lobbying. And that's what we are.
Okay.
We're a satanic organization.
When people hear Satanic Temple, of course, they're thinking that you are all what is commonly called devil worshipers, that you sacrifice children, that you have ceremonies involving goats and fire and black robes. And is that what we're talking about here?
No, those kind of satanic cults never existed, but that's actually where my interest in Satanism started. It started with that kind of mythology. Of course, I didn't want to be involved in anything that would be similar to what was being said during what sociologists now call the satanic panic, taking place in the primarily the 80s and 90s, where there was this prevalent fear throughout our culture of this conspiracy of Satanists. But honestly, I'm an atheist, and I've always been quite open about that, and the Satanic Temple is poised as a atheistic religious organization. And this causes a lot of confusion with some people who think that position is nonsensical and paradoxical, that you can't be both atheist and a religious organization. But to us, Satanism is used as a metaphor. It's a metaphorical narrative construct by which we contextualize our works and our goals. It gives us a sense of community, a sense of identity, a sense of purpose, a symbolic background, which we feel are the enriching and important parts of religion to begin with. And another criticism we get is that why can't we, you know, we essentially stand for a common sense, reasonable, just causes and that type of thing. Why must it be called Satanism? Well, even though we're atheistic, the whole cultural construct of Satanism resonates quite strongly with no insignificant segment of the population, and I'm one of those people. And it is the best narrative construct that embodies our rejection of arbitrary authority, our respect for personal sovereignty, and our draw towards the forbidden.
Let me recharacterize it in a way, and you tell me if I'm understanding you correctly. It sounds to me like you and your compatriots might be described as free thinkers, might be described as, to some extent, libertarians, who do not like authority, maybe particularly religious authority, and that you find what you call the literary narrative of Satan to be one that appeals to you and that also serves your political purposes.
Right. Well, it's the narrative that starts with Milton and moves on up to characters like Anatole France and was explicated by the romantic literary figures from Byron and Shelley. That kind of Satan. The Satan in the Bible is actually a rather contradictory character from book to book. In the book of Job, he's in good standing in God's court and is really acting at God's behest when he starts antagonizing Job. And then it becomes, in the New Testament, this kind of millenarian construct. But
Wait a second. Millenarian construct.
Yeah, well, you know, the early Christians being a millenarian cult, the kind of apocalyptic cult that seemed to draw from Zoroastrianism in viewing the universe as this constant struggle against an ultimate good and an ultimate evil.
And so they needed an ultimate evil, you're saying? And they made Lucifer into that ultimate evil?
Correct. And I don't have respect for that part of the narrative insofar as I see the kind of harm it's done. When you have this kind of supernatural embodiment of evil, and you have throughout history also these people trying to find the human helpers here on Earth, and you start getting this creation of outgroups and witch hunts and that type of thing, and we reject that type of mob mentality in general. There's this distinction that was set up. I forget who was the first to use this distinction, but it was distinction between left-hand path and right-hand path religions, right-hand path being standard Judeo-Christian constructs, and the drive is to achieve some kind of oneness with the whole, you know, to pledge fealty to a godlike character and you know, assimilate oneself with the universe. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know, at the basic core of it. But at its worst, of course, it can lead to this mindless conformity. The left-hand path are people whose appeal is more towards building oneself up as an individual, as an isolate intelligence, free from, you know, certain cultural baggage or coercion. And that's the type of person that the satanic construct appeals to. And at the worst of that, you can have antisocial people, you know, sociopathic or whatever else. So they both have their best and their worst qualities. I think it just comes down to what kind of person you are. And I don't think every atheist will find an appeal in Satanism, you know, even though this is an atheistic religious construct. I don't think it's for atheists in general. I think you know, there could be atheistic Christians. I've talked to some atheistic Muslims, and they're able to be rid of the archaic and not feel forced to subscribe to the supernatural elements, but still the cultural elements resonate with them, the basic modern morality that they find. Also still fits the narrative of their religion today.
Interesting. So, you mentioned a couple of things I'd like to pick up on. First of all, you mentioned that the Bible itself is not entirely consistent in its treatment of Lucifer. At times he seems to be working at the behest of God. At other times, clearly he's on the wrong side of God, probably most notably in the tale of the Garden of Eden. But that tale seems to represent what you reject, because, of course, what Satan, through the snake, is offering Eve and Adam is the knowledge of good and evil. And that is seen, as, of course, as a very bad thing. You, I'm guessing, would say that that is actually a gift.
Well, yeah, the pursuit of knowledge is definitely, you know, one of the highest callings, we feel, you know, the a reasonable exploration, you know, letting all the facts be seen, even where they might be uncomfortable, you know, that even that plays in somewhat towards that drive toward the forbidden, but the unconstrained knowledge. But it should be mentioned that in Genesis, it was never actually said that the snake was Lucifer. But
My mistake. I always thought that that was, I always kind of assumed they were one and the same.
Well, that's what it becomes later on. That's how it's construed construed by people today. I'm not sure where that first became part of the narrative. Obviously, some point after the New Testament was put into place. But I prefer that part of the narrative. But, you know, this is literary interpretation the way I see it. You know, it's subject to a certain malleability, and there's certain agreed upon things. Even 666 didn't have this kind of prominence in our culture until the film The Omen, and people don't really tend to realize that. And the idea of a black mass never really meant anything in the United States, or to the Protestant United States as it is. It was kind of this Catholic scare story in Europe, and it didn't mean much to us till the novels of Dennis Wheatley. So it's kind of surprising to people how modern some of the satanic construct is. But nonetheless, it resonates with us so deeply, because it's something we feel we're inculcated with early on in our culture.
Was the movie The Omen one of the things that first got you interested in Satanism?
No, actually, it was the tales of the Satanic Panic, these horrific stories of these roving satanic cults. And of course, as I said, I didn't want anything to do with those kinds of cults. I thought that was terrifying. But later on, when I was started, about time when I was getting out of high school, I started wondering, whatever happened to these cults? Was there any truth to these stories at all? Because I remember these Geraldo specials and everything, and there would be these people talking about how they had been tortured by Satanists, and how they had witnessed infant sacrifice. And you know, as a little kid, and you see this on television, you think there must be validity to it. You kind of watch it unquestioningly. Later on, I was thinking, how could this massive criminal enterprise have slipped by fairly unnoticed? I heard these terribly salacious stories, and then nothing thereafter. So I actually started looking to see what the truth was to these kinds of stories. And I find that there is a Church of Satan, and I started meeting people who were involved with them, and people who had been friends with Anton LaVey, who had authored the Satanic Bible in the 60s and founded the Church of Satan. And, you know, they're not an active organization. They don't really do anything except sell membership cards at this point. And so the idea that they were involved in any organized behavior just didn't seem credible at all, because they can hardly manage what they have ostensibly. So I was hearing from the conspiracy theorists who were working with this kind of mythology of Satanism and still saying that it existed in this background, was that the real satanic cult, the real problem was the Process Church of the Final Judgment. They were some 60s cult, and they were supposed to be the world's most dangerous satanic cult. And I started looking for people who were a membership of that organization, which it's now defunct. And they were a spin-off group from Scientology, and they weren't really Satanist as such. They had this kind of Western Taoist conception of the reconciliation of opposites, that Christ and Satan come together for the end of the world. They kind of had this apocalyptic narration of their own. But I met some of the people who were the core membership of the Process, and they were very intelligent, creative people. It was odd to see that they had gotten involved in this cult life. But there was certainly no no evidence of any of the horrible things that were said about them. They were very much an animal rights activist group and seemed to have deep concern for human rights and in general, those types of things.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Lucian Greaves, the spokesman for a place called the Satanic Temple. And he's just telling me that his own investigations as a young man turned up that devil worshippers were, at worst, a bunch of animal rights activists. We'll hear more from Lucian after the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now I'm going to continue my discussion with Lucian Greaves, the spokesman for a place called the Satanic Temple. Now, the reason we're talking to him is not just because it's a fascinating discussion, but because he's actually trying to place a monument on the courthouse steps, or actually the state capitol steps in Oklahoma. Well, I'll let him tell you what sort of reaction he got. But before we get there, we need a little bit more background. It seems that Lucian was misled by some TV talk shows, including one you've probably heard of.
What I'm hearing is that your entire spiritual awakening seems to have originated in an attempt to debunk Geraldo Rivera.
Well, it didn't even start out as an attempt to debunk. So it wasn't just Geraldo either. There was just a massive... There was just a massive movement at the time, and maybe it was more prominent where I was growing up than some other places in the United States, but the Satanic Panic definitely did have an effect on me as a child.
Where were you growing up, if I may ask?
Detroit.
Oh, really? Detroit. Well, for heaven's sake, Detroit keeps popping up in this show. I'm from Detroit, and so is our executive producer, Wayne Winkler.
Oh, really?
Yes, it is. I guess there's just something about us Detroiters, or us ex-Detroiters. But having grown up, I think, a few years before you did, but in the same area, I saw some of the same films that you've mentioned. You mentioned The Omen, and as I was thinking about that, I was thinking, my gosh, the same era The Exorcist came out, and also another very prominent film called Rosemary's Baby about the Antichrist. And I wonder if all of this satanic panic was simply a response to those literary endeavors.
Well, there was a perfect storm at the time because that mythology started gaining traction within our culture. And these weren't presented as anything other than fiction, as far as I can tell. Nobody was supposed to take them seriously. But you had different social factors. You had a general fear of cults at that time, and you had a strong anti-cult movement, and of course Jim Jones had his group of people drink cyanide-laced Kool-Aid and die.
And yeah, that was like in 77 or so, wasn't it? Right around there.
Yeah, and of course the Manson cult really disturbed people as well, and so there was kind of a drive towards a return to conservative values, religious values at that point. And there was also this burgeoning daycare culture that was coming by, which was kind of a new thing. And there was a general fear of people submitting their kids to others who would watch over them during the day, and the loss of the nuclear family and that kind of thing. And then there was
Of these satanic ritual things had to do with daycares. That's what was prompting some of the alleged child abuse that was occurring.
Right. And there was also at that time, you know, a certain rise there was a certain factions of feminism that felt that any claim of abuse needed to be taken at its face value as well. And then on top of all that, what brings it all together is you have the recovered memory movement within psychotherapy, where the idea was that you could, by way of regression hypnosis or sodium amytal interview, draw forth repressed memories that would provide the key to understanding what it was that was causing any particular mental malaise, whether it be something as simple as somebody's having trouble holding a job or depressed or whatever else. Often the assumption would be that there was a hidden psychic trauma in the background of somebody's mind that needed to be revealed. And in that Freudian sense, people knew that when they're repressing a memory, really generally what the content of that memory is supposed to be, and that's sexual abuse. And what's been found is that when people go through this kind of regression, they have the sodium amytal interviews, they have a sense of what the person regressing them is looking for, and they tend to respond to that, and they tend to confabulate false memories that remarkably fall in place with what the expectations were to begin with. I mean, it's worth mentioning that this is entirely what alien abduction narratives are based on. And it's the same thing. Somebody goes into an abduction therapist, and they tend to recover that exact type of narrative.
Now, wait a second. Now, I saw another movie called Independence Day, and I thought they vindicated those alien abduction claims. All right. So whatever the reason, or maybe a combination of reason, as you say, there's a perfect storm. There's the satanic panic that happens in the 70s and 80s. You see it. You are curious about it. You begin investigating it. And apparently you come to the conclusion that this was all, what, just a popular imagination, a popular myth?
Yeah, and an amazing one at that. It was a pretty elaborate hysteria, and I think it's very underplayed in our cultural history. I think it's one of the most amazing things that that's happened in recent history, and to understand it would be, I think, has ramifications for so many things, and it's very important to understand. But and it still goes on to a certain degree. It's gotten a lot less traction within the media and the courts. But you still find this fringe culture within psychotherapy that still promotes these ideas of satanic ritual abuse and other things like that, where they're creating this convenient scapegoat of Satanists that don't exist. And hopefully, I think what we do with the Satanic Temple is take away people's ability to create that imaginary outgroup and force them to look at people for their real actions in the real world, rather than pointing at them and saying they use satanic imagery or they don't pledge fealty to arbitrary social norms in some other way, and use that to attach criminal or antisocial behavior to them.
That's sort of interesting. I would generalize then. Again, you tell me if I'm understanding you correctly, but it seems that you are wanting everyone to look more at actions and intentions than labels. Less controversial a use of that might be the claim by people on the left that everybody who opposes them is a right-wing nut, or conversely by people on the right that everybody who opposes them is some sort of liberal, which has been turned into a bad word. In other words, both sides are trying to label the other rather than engaging directly with what the other side is saying and doing. And is that what you're objecting to?
Right, that's exactly it. And we don't care to micromanage people's beliefs. We have this very basic structure. We have some very basic tenets. And but ultimately, we want to stand in defense of the maligned outgroups, the unjustly outcast, the slandered minorities, that kind of thing, and force people to look at those, you know, in an open-minded way at what they're actually dealing with, and realize that this kind of mythology we have about Satanism was for centuries applied to Jews. You know, it was said that Jews did exactly these things, the infant sacrifice, the rituals, even worshiping Satan was said to be part of the Jewish way. And during the, you know, of course, during the Crusades, Islam was Satan, maybe still is to a certain degree in certain areas of the United States. But the name Baphomet, which I know we're going to get to talking about the sculpture the Satanic Temple is trying to have placed in Oklahoma, but the character in the sculpture is called Baphomet, and the word Baphomet comes from the heresy trials of the Knights Templar. And the word Baphomet, it was said that they worshipped an idol called Baphomet, which almost certainly comes from Mahomet or Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. So I think it's important that people realize that this idea of Satanism we have is constructed from these kind of horrible witch hunts, this kind of creation of outgroups that's gone on throughout history. And it's no less deplorable now than it was before, and we just can't let it happen. We need to reconcile ourselves to the differences people have and the differences of opinion and the differences of aesthetic and symbology.
Well, you've done it. You have mentioned Oklahoma City, and that, of course, is the reason that I first heard of you and the reason I first contacted you. So please tell me what you all are up to in that state capital.
Well, the thing that was is that at the Oklahoma State Capitol, they apparently decided that it wasn't a breach of church and state to allow a privately donated Ten Commandments monument to stand outside the state capitol. So the ACLU filed suit in disagreement, saying that you just can't have a Ten Commandments monument. It gives the impression that one religious philosophy has co-opted the power and authority of the state government. And
the claim there is based upon what we call the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which reads, and I believe I'm quoting verbatim, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion." And that's widely paraphrased as saying that, you know, no government in our country can have an official church or, quite frankly, can do much of anything that tends toward that, such as taking one religious symbol and placing it in a prominent place in a public property.
Right, and they avoided the Establishment Clause issue by allowing a private donation, which appears to mean that they weren't making any value judgments upon the material that would be submitted as a private donation. And, of course, implicit in that is that anybody's free to privately donate a monument. And so... It was somebody in the state legislature, Mike Ritz, who donated the Ten Commandments monument, and there was a somebody I don't remember if it was the Attorney General representing the state of Oklahoma and Mike Ritz when the ACLU filed suit, but at some point they had said that it was a moot point because they imagined that this area outside the state capitol would be reserved for the construction of some kind of monument park. The idea there again being that anybody could put a monument there. So we had standing in Oklahoma, which is to say that we have membership in Oklahoma, so we could file on their behalf that we too want to put a monument to complement and contrast the Ten Commandments.
Oh boy, I think I know what's coming now.
Yeah, so we sent a letter to Oklahoma and said that we would like to put a satanic monument next to the Ten Commandments at the state of Oklahoma.
At which point they said, oh, thanks very much. We know exactly where to put it, right?
No, but the only contact we did get back from Oklahoma was at the point where they wrote us back and asked us to submit our designs for the monument we intended to create. And so... we started up a crowdsourcing campaign on Indiegogo where people could help us fund this monument being put up. And we exceeded the amount that we asked for. This got a lot of press and people started submitting and a lot
of
people.
How much did you raise?
About 30 grand.
Wow.
Yeah, and we had put in for 20, I think.
What does this monument look like?
Well, as I was saying, the character is known as Baphomet in the name coming from the Templar accusations, but it wasn't till much later that a occult historian artist, Eliphas Levi, drew this picture of this kind of hermaphroditic part human, part goat. It has a goat head creature.
Excuse
with,
me for laughing. Did it have wings too?
Yeah, with angel wings and horns, and one hand points above and the other hand points below. There's a caduceus at the center, which is, you see that on hospitals, like the entwined snakes around the staff. And has hooved feet, and we have him sitting so that the lap can also be used as a chair. People can have their pictures taken. Whatever, and it's flanked by a couple of happy children on either side. There'll be a stone slab behind the Baphomet, and the stone slab has the inverted pentagram on it, kind of the universal symbol of Satanism today.
Okay, reason I'm laughing here, let me just explain myself. Well, the reason I'm laughing is because it seems that you have hit about every possible way to offend as many people as possible.
Well, it's funny because I released the design, and the imagery of the Baphomet creature is intentionally not constructed to look evil, you know.
Except that it's a goat.
Well, no, goats are our friends.
All right, go on.
But it doesn't have an evil expression on its face, you know. It's just this kind of. And it has these angelic wings. It's just funny because there was such a diversity of. Actually, there wasn't a diversity of opinion. There's polarized opinions on the design. Some people saw it. They said it looked very, very approachable. It was very much a wonderful work of art, that kind of thing.
A happy Satan.
What's that?
A happy Satan.
Right.
Okay.
Well, a neutral Satan, really. I didn't want something where kids without any cultural baggage would look at it and find it horrifying. I have this idea that kids who see it and they're not exposed to any preconceived notions will want to run over and sit on the lap and play on this structure.
On the lap of a hooved being with a goat's head and wings? You think kids are going to run up and want to get on that lap?
I think so. We'll see.
I guess so.
Well, I really, really hate to do this, but that's all the time we have today for Lucian Greaves of the Satanic Temple. And you can love him or you can hate him, but I think you'll agree he is a very articulate, very thoughtful, very intelligent, and fascinating fellow to talk to. So we're just going to have a second episode on the Satanic Temple and its efforts down in Oklahoma, and you're just going to have to tune in next week. Sorry about that.
Just as every cop is a criminal, and all the sinners. As heads as tails, just call me Lucifer, 'cause I'm in need of some restraint. So if you meet me, have some courtesy, have some sympathy, and some taste. Use all your well-learned politics, or I'll lay your soul to waste.
In the meantime, I'll tell you that our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our music is done by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Remember, you are a part, no matter what your religion, you are a part of the American experiment. Get on there.